Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the ambitious effort to end homelessness in Fresno and Kern County. Plus, drinking water conditions compared to a third world country. What's taking so long to provide some residents in Tulare County with clean water? Plus, what's cooking at the Big Fresno Fair? But first, the city of Fresno and Kern County have both developed 10-year plans to end homelessness. Is that a realistic effort? Joining me today to discuss this issue is Gregory Barfield. He is executive, he's the Homeless Prevention and Policy Manager at the City of Fresno. Also joining us is Stephen Peltz. He's the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Kern County. Thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, my first question, and I'll have Mr. Barfield answer it first, is really when you look at this whole effort, we're talking about a 10-year plan to end homelessness. Is that really a realistic effort?
Well, you're never going to end homelessness. But what you need to do is be able to have the mechanisms and systems in place in order to support individuals so that they don't fall into homelessness, whether it's a prevention program, whether it's rapid rehousing, whether it's counseling. Those types of things need to be put in place in order to prevent folks from losing their homes.
And Mr. Peltz, Kern County also has a 10-year plan as well.
That's correct, yeah. And our 10-year plan is actually a 10-year plan in chronic homelessness. And so the focus is that those that have been in homelessness for a long period of time or multiple times within the past few years, really can we make an effort to reduce or eliminate that segment of the homeless population while making progress on the entire homeless population? We do recognize that there are it's going to be difficult to completely eliminate homelessness, but certainly chronically homelessness is our focus.
Let's take a look at how each area is handling this issue. And for Fresno, the whole issue, the plan got a boost with Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen's First Steps Home program. Now, the goal is to raise $1 million a year over the next 10 years to help address the problem. Mr. Barfield, how is that going?
Well, we're at the $500,000 mark. The mayor's initiative that she launched, Fresno First Steps Home, was really a way to help continue some good work that we've been doing using some economic stimulus money. Through the Homeless Prevention and Rapid Rehousing, or HPRP program, our community was granted $5 million for a three-year period. And that money is running out. And so this money is to allow us to continue that good work that we've been doing over the last 2 years.
And First Steps Home, you just awarded your first grant. So you're beginning to put that money out there to be used.
Right. Our first major competitive grant was just announced. The Housing Authority of the City and County of Fresno received $250,000. That is a very targeted grant to serve minimum of 20 individuals who are currently unhoused and living in encampments south of Ventura.
And that's what have been your huge efforts over the last couple of years. It's just to move people out of those encampments, to move people off the street.
Correct. We have focused a great deal of our time and effort on that initiative. However, we've also done a lot of work to prevent people from falling into homelessness, too, using that economic stimulus money. In the last 2 years, we're proud to report 2,802 people have been served using that stimulus money in our community. And so, you know, we're extremely happy that we're continuing to keep people from falling into homelessness, rapidly rehouse, and then address the encampments also.
You know, what does it take, because we, especially in these tough economic times, to keep people from falling into homelessness? You're probably seeing more people. And is it just trying to get them into some kind of emergency housing or some kind to stabilize them in housing before they have to hit the streets?
No, the best place really is to keep a person in their existing housing environment. And if that's not possible, you want to rapidly put them into a place that they can call their own. With this economic downturn, you know, we see a number of families who are doubled up, in some cases tripled up, and the tension that may be created by many of us living in a smaller environment now, could cause one or several of us to fall into homelessness. And so, you know, we want to be able to be there to prevent that from happening. And whether it's assisting with arrears on the rent or, moving a doubled-up family, separating a doubled-up family so each has their own place to call their own is also important in our community.
And Mr. Peltz, it's my understanding that Kern County recently received a $2.6 million grant. Now, I know here in Fresno, and we're going to talk about that in just a moment, that there's a huge building effort. How are you addressing getting people off the streets with the dollars that you have?
Well, we've really had to change the strategy of how we tackle homelessness with the Home First plan that our mayor led in getting it created and adopted back in 2008. Really changes the model of our services to what we call housing first, and that is in the past most communities, including ours, focused on providing services to the homeless in the streets, focused on emergency shelters and transitional housing, which are all very important things. But we recognized, and there's a lot of research to this, that in order for the homeless to really get out of homelessness, they need to get into housing first and then be able to work on the other issues that may have led them to get into homelessness, whether it's substance abuse or mental illness or other issues. And so we've made that difficult transition over the past few years and been able to really start focusing on how can we build permanent supportive housing or through voucher programs and be able to expand those resources to get them off the streets, and then couple the services with the housing. And so we've seen progress in these last few years that we've just been really excited about.
And that really is one of the big issues. Many of the people who are on the street, they do have other problems, and unless you address those, it's kind of hard moving them out of that environment.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, you think about it, if you're on the street, you're sleeping on the street or even in a shelter and you're trying to deal with a mental illness or substance abuse, it's really tough. And to be able to have a safe place to live, a warm bed, and be able to then have the services and plug into that, we find it to be more successful that way. But it creates a lot of, we had to make some serious changes in the way our system worked and what programs got funded. And we had to eliminate a number of programs so that we could redirect funding towards a housing first focus.
Okay. And here in Fresno, we're doing similar issues as far as trying to address, because you find that many people who are living on the streets do have mental health issues and substance abuse issues.
Absolutely. We, too, have a housing first plan. Our plan, adopted in September of 2008 by both the city and the county, does call for housing first. What, just like Scott said, those wraparound ability to provide the services. I think it's important, though, that folks understand that without that address, it makes it very difficult for many of us to either provide services or receive services. So, having a stable address to call my own is the most important thing that we can do in order to not only reduce homelessness, but more importantly, reduce a person's dependence on those safety nets that are out there.
And with that, Fresno is really in the midst of a kind of ambitious building program to get these people off the streets, as you put it, a home first to get them into some kind of a housing situation. Because number one, there wasn't enough housing. We had people on the streets, and we also had people putting people up in motels, which isn't cheap either.
No, not at all. No, we have taken, we have just crossed the third year anniversary of our 10-year plan. And in it, it did call for these permanent supportive housing units to be brought online. So in the next, 8 to 12 months, you'll see all of 122 new units that were originally proposed come online. We're also being really aggressive in working with the Apartment Association to scatter where folks go that access vouchers and services from us.
And, and just like any project, any ambitious project, there has been some criticism to go with this. And you will probably meet opposition. You know, everybody wants to help, but they don't want it in their neighborhood,
Absolutely.
So to speak.
Absolutely. And that's no different in Fresno or in Kern County or in Seattle or in Denver or anywhere else. So you've got to be able to put a face to this situation. And that face could be yours or mine.
And for our listeners out there, how would you feel about this? You know, the city, as far as I know, you've got one completed and you're in the process of building two more. Some of the city council members don't want them concentrated in one area and saying we want them spread around the city. How would you feel about one of these buildings being built in your neighborhood? We'd like to hear from you. You can call us toll free at 800-224-8989. Or 559-275-8989, or online at kbpr.org. Or if you have another suggestion you'd like to bring up on how we address our homelessness issue, either way, we'd like to hear from you. Now, let me get back to Kern County. Are you all in a building phase, or are you putting people up in existing properties?
We're doing both. We have some properties that have been built. We just finished a 24-unit permanent supportive housing project for mentally ill homeless. It was called Haven Cottages. It opened last month. And we have one of the agencies in our collaborative received funding to build another project, and that will be starting in 6 months. That will serve transition-age youth that are homeless or at risk of homelessness. But then we've also had a pretty significant expansion in our voucher programs for veterans, for disabled homeless, for other special populations. And that's where they're located in units that are with private landlords, so in apartments or homes throughout the community. And the service providers provide supportive services directly to them. So they could be a neighbor of somebody, and they may not know that because they may just look like any other renter, but they just were formerly homeless.
Now, the supportive services are key to making this work, and you are kind of getting a boost from a recently passed legislation here in I think California, where certain monies do go to mental health programs. How much is that helping you?
Well, there's a program called the Mental Health Services Act, and that's been tremendously helpful. That was provided the majority of funding for our Haven Cottages permanent housing development. It provided a substantial portion of the funding for the other project for transition-age youth, and then it also is funding some more innovative mental health services in the community, that some of which are targeted towards the homeless. So that's been great. But we know that is a source, particularly on the development side, that won't always be there in the future, and so we have a challenge of being able to figure out how we're going to continue this going forward.
Yeah, and we too here in Fresno, have taken on that same usage of money through the Mental Health Services Act. The first two developments. Altamonte, the one that just begin its rehab in December, and Trinity, which just opened, both are fully funded by the Mental Health Services Act with support through the Housing Authority. And then Santa Clara, the 70-unit new construction project that we will begin in December also, has a mix of funding. So these things are tough to do, but have been on the drawing board for some time. The difficulty is they take a lot of subsidy that are needed in the services side of it, which is also a good thing for an individual neighbor or community that may have these individuals that may be their neighbors in the future.
But is there a concern with that, with this whole issue? You know, it is a good thing. I think all people agree you need to do something so people aren't on the streets. But what do you do if the money runs out? You know, it's really hard to get anything funded these days, and you can get these programs up and running. But as you said, it is sustaining them.
Well, I think the good thing about using mental health services money and many of the other permanent supportive housing programs that we do, it does provide that long-term subsidy. So the cost of these programs may seem very huge, but it does provide for services that are 15 and 30 years out that we've paid for up front, as well as that subsidy that for the rental assistance that will go for each of these units. So we front-loaded these projects with enough supportive services and money so that, 15, 20 years down the road, those things are still funded, and that's a good thing for us.
Well, that looks like to me that that's the difference here, is that a lot of times people will put projects out there without the funding, and you all have decided to go with this in a way that if we're going to put a project out there, we're going to make sure it's funded, and it's funded for a period of time. And maybe, and that's why the cost is so high now?
That's why the cost is so high. I mean, we've got enough programming that we know is going to be short-lived. HPRP, which was $1.5 billion in the stimulus, we knew was going to be short-lived. We knew we had less than 36 months to expend our $5 million in our community. And every community was like that. We also were told up front, you're not going to expect additional funds. So we've already begun to look at changing our systems and some of our current funding scenarios to allow for what we would now term HPRP Junior to come about to continue this kind of great work that we do here in our community.
What about the concern that some of the housing, especially the housing unit that you are building next to the Pavarello House, could just end up being, a huge kind of, for better use of a word, slum? Because you're putting it in a neighborhood or an area where, there people say there's a lot of drug activity or, people are on the streets with substance abuse. And, you have this whole issue where when it comes to treatment, people say you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And you're going to have some of those folks who are just not going to be willing to abide by the rules that could keep them in the housing.
Well, I think what you have to do is almost close your eyes and look to the future. That what you see currently won't exist in the very near future. We are moving toward the elimination of those last remaining encampments south of Ventura. But think of that neighborhood with a beautiful housing unit that has enough subsidy to last for 30 years, that also has services. So even if I did not have housing there, that could be one of my connections into a program or into housing in the future. So we're also changing neighborhoods. And so why not start in this particular neighborhood that has been ground zero?
Okay. And Mr. Peltz, in Kern County, are there certain areas where you all are building the facilities?
Yeah. I mean, some of the projects that we have are built in areas where the homeless tend to be. And there's a few reasons for that. I mean, one is that's where they're familiar in terms of where things are and where they like to be. But it's also because of accessibility of land or other reasons like that. But I think the key, as my colleague from Fresno alluded to, is having a quality plan in place and making sure you develop quality projects that are properly managed, that you have good management, and that the services are there and they're funded in advance so that you can ensure that they're going to continue. And so what you're doing is taking people off the street that have serious issues that I think the public may be concerned about, and actually putting them in housing and getting them the services they need. So the net effect on the community is a real benefit.
Okay. Mr. Barfield, with the projects that you all, have in the works right now, how much of the First Steps Home program, the money that you're trying to raise? You know, the mayor has a goal of trying to raise, you know, I think it is $1 million
right.
every year. And so the program has been in effect for, what, 2 years now?
Just over a year.
Over a year?
Just over a year.
And you have a half a million.
We raised half a million.
Okay.
So even in this tough economy, you know, getting to half a million has been difficult. But I think we're well on our way. We've got, you know, a good board in place. You know, it's an independent nonprofit now that has been completely severed from the city of Fresno. And so I think, you know, we're well on our way now with showing the community what we can do.
Yeah, it's a good effort to try to show that you that the community itself to get involved, and you don't have to do everything with government money.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. Anne in Fresno, Anne, you have a question?
Yes, I do. My impression is that in the newspaper recently, it noticed that there were over 4,000 homeless people in the Fresno area. And as I drive down into the area around Poverello House, I notice that the people there don't seem to have places. They don't seem to have fresh water. They don't seem to have places to put their garbage. And I don't know that there's any place for them to have bathrooms. And I'm wondering if the city is going to be handling that issue. That's more of an immediate issue, even though your long-term plans sound very good. But immediately there are these kinds of issues that I think we need to address also. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ann. Actually, the city's policy is housing first. And many of those individuals who are in and around the Poverello right now have access to programs and housing if they so choose to take it. And the difficulty has been really ensuring that they follow up on their side of it. It's a two-way street. So, you know, we've opened the system and they've got to be able to come accept it.
Also, we have Fuji. He owns a business in downtown. And you have a question?
Yes, I do. I had the same issue that Ann had about sanitation in the area. And it's a real concern because it's a health issue. We cannot have, as merchants down there, we can't have people using the walls and our, you know, the alleyways and the streets to do their bodily functions. And I know it's not their fault. They, you know, there's nothing down there for them in their, where their encampment is to take care of a lot of these issues. And I'm really upset because now they're talking about possibly cutting back or not even having our bicycle patrol down there. And they're the only ones that we can communicate with instantly, and they're the only ones that know who the merchants are. They know the people down there. And if they eliminate the bicycle patrol, we won't have anybody that helps us down there from the police department. I mean, we can call the 911, but, you know, they've got, I mean, that's, the response is so slow. It's so much to have the bicycle patrol come out.
That is a problem. Thank you for calling in. We'll try to get that answered for you.
No, absolutely. And thank you again. It's always great to hear your voice. The encampments that the last three remaining south of Ventura are soon to be eliminated. The noticing has gone up on the first one, and the other two will go up very soon. For a number of reasons. One, you know, we are going to be building a 70-unit a residency right there, and so we need to clear the construction zone. But more importantly, the Monterey Street Bridge finally will be the demolition of the Monterey Street Bridge will finally occur beginning in January, and so we need to clear that area in preparation for that. But we've always said that, you know, encampments are not the answer. That's not what we want in our community. It makes no sense, particularly when it comes to solving the problem, that the elimination of the encampments is a key thing that we're working on. And we've been trying to, not only assess who's there, but also begin to provide housing to those individuals. And we had a little bit of success with moving a few people from that area into the Trinity development, but that was only 20 units. And so that's what the First Steps Home Money will focus on. And the Housing Authority has also matched it with another grant of equal amount. So that $500,000 right now is being used to begin to house individuals who are in that area. So very soon, we hope by the end of November, those encampments will be gone.
And help you address the encampment issue in Kern County, Mr. Peltz?
Well, we don't have any large encampments, but we do have some encampments that are along our Kern River. It runs through town and in some of the other areas and rural areas. But it's not as concentrated, which is fortunate, but it also makes it somewhat more difficult then because the outreach has to be spread out and under a wider area to access the community. But we're pleased because we've just now been able to restore some street outreach staff through our collaborative. We have a really good partnership with several faith-based organizations and nonprofits, and that function of street outreach, of people going out on the streets and really trying to connect people to services and housing, has been absent from our community for several years. And so we're getting that back into place. And with the housing units that we've added, we feel like we can continue to make progress on that.
Well, I think it's only fair to say that at least in this situation in Kern County and here in Fresno, we both areas have plans in place to address the situation. So at least we are taking that first step to try to solve the problem, and we're putting some money into the issue. So we'll continue to talk about this as we move forward. And I want to thank both of you for joining us this morning. Stephen Peltz, Executive Director, Housing Authority of Kern County, and Gregory Barfield, the Homeless Prevention and Policy Manager for the City of Fresno. We'll be right back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. What would you do if your only source of drinking water was contaminated with nitrates, a chemical that is linked to cancer, birth defects, and a host of medical problems? For many residents in towns located in Tulare County, that's it. That's what they face, and they faced that problem for years. Thus far, no action or relief from the State Department of Public Health, Tulare County supervisors, or any of the agencies that could help. Joining us to discuss this issue is Laurel Firestone, co-director, Community Water Center, and an attorney. She has been fighting to bring clean water to communities like Tuleyville for years. She joins us, as well as Kara Brodfear, California Rural Legal Assistance. She's a staff attorney. Thank you both. This issue has been in the news quite a bit lately, and I think as I read it, I keep up with it. We're talking about a basic drinking water. It's something that everybody should have. What has been the problem here? Starting with you, Laurel, because you've been in this fight for a long time.
Yeah, you know, it's something that when I first came to the Valley, I was had taken it for granted that everyone has safe drinking water in the U.S. and particularly in California. And, the reality is that many of our communities don't and haven't for over a decade, mostly due to groundwater contamination. We live in an agricultural area rely primarily on groundwater. And so the things that we do on the surface influence the quality of water that we pump out of the ground. And we really haven't been protecting our groundwater and our drinking water sources the way that we need to. And so communities, like many of the rural communities, rely on, one or two wells. And when one well becomes contaminated, they're without a drinking water source. And additionally, we've had, a government that, whether on the local, state, or regional levels or federal levels, have really not prioritized rural communities in terms of planning and funding and in terms of getting long-term solutions that can address drinking water challenges. So many communities have been waiting for over a decade to get funding to get a new drinking water source or replace their dilapidated pipes. And so, you know, there's a sort of pattern of low-income rural communities not having adequate infrastructure, having contaminated drinking water sources, and really being kind of left on their own to have to navigate the bureaucracies and get the resources that they need to create solutions.
And Kara, is it Brodeff?
Oh, Brodeffier?
Brodeffier. And you're with California Rural Legal Assistance. And when you read about these problems and the issues, I mean, they're all concentrated in the same areas, rural towns here in the valley, where much of the population are poor farm workers. Is that part of the problem? We don't see a solution to this.
I think, you know, number one, in the Central Valley, this issue is concentrated in low-income areas. I think, as Laurel said, a lot of times these small communities have really been left behind because a lot of them kind of sprang out of farm labor camps years and years ago. These communities really don't have a local government structure or a local government that's really looking out for their needs. And because of that, they've really been left behind with their infrastructure. A lot of folks in these communities are running their own water systems kind of on their own time after working all day. And, you know, obviously drinking water issues are a huge issue, and they're something that, you know, takes a lot of resources and expertise to deal with, and they're just not getting the support they need. They're not getting the funding and resources they need.
And these folks who can least afford it are now having to spend, the few dollars they have on bottled water, and if mm-hmm. they can't afford that, they just drink the water out of the tap.
Yeah, we did a survey in a number of communities with contaminated water and found that many people were, even when they were buying bottled water and spending, you know, a significant amount, anywhere from 2 to 10% of their income on drinking water alone, that they were also still consuming the water, whether it's for cooking, making tea, and things like that. And so, you know, one of the challenges is just getting good information to people about what's in their water, what they can do to protect themselves. But I also just want to highlight that this isn't this most impacts the small low-income communities, and particularly Latino and farm worker communities, because those are the communities that are most vulnerable. They usually rely on just one or two wells, and so they have the least capacity to mitigate problems that arise. But this is an issue that really affects the entire valley, and it's not just just a farm worker problem or just a rural community problem. I mean, even many of the cities like Modesto, Fresno, Visalia, Porterville have had to close wells because of nitrate or other groundwater contaminants. And that reduces the water supply available to residents and businesses. And so economic development is impacted in a lot of areas. You know, for example, in Arvin, I was just working with just at a meeting where they had to, you know, they're not able to supply it to allow affordable housing projects to go forward, a city park to go forward, and even a community garden to go forward because they don't have enough water supply because they've had to close their wells due to groundwater contamination. So even many communities that have safe water are impacted by this problem. So, you know, it's something that really affects our entire region and our regional economy and not just the health and sort of well-being of rural residents. But I think rural residents are in many ways the sort of canary in the coal mine, and that the effects on our communities and our poorest communities are the most extreme and most severe.
And I'm just to piggyback on that really quickly too, you know, and this isn't just a regional issue, it's a statewide issue. And, you know, there's
why isn't the, from what I've been able to read, the State Department of Health making this a priority?
I think, you know, rural residents and all residents with contaminated drinking water are asking the same question. That was kind of the crux of the case that we just settled against the Department of Public Health. I think, you know, the Department of Public Health, at least for the case that we filed, they're required to do a statewide plan to improve drinking water in all communities across the state of California. I mean, they're definitely supposed to look in this plan at small communities, but it's a statewide plan. And since they were given that charge to do so, they've never done it. And I think, you know, the case is on behalf of all residents in Tulare County and small rural communities. But, you know, they were asking the same question. And, you know, in our case, at least, they said that they didn't have enough funding to do it. But we don't think that that was an excuse. The court didn't think that that was an excuse. And, you know, we're very excited to now have settled the case, and they're going to do a statewide plan for drinking water. And it's going to look at a lot of the issues that Laurel talked about. It's going to look at everything from affordability, particularly for small water
systems.
So you
have to take them to court over this issue.
We did have to take them to court. Laurel works for the Community Water Center, and they organize a group called the Agua Coalition. It's a coalition of about 17 unincorporated communities with drinking water issues in Tulare County. We also represented an individual person named Cynthia Newton Enlow. She's from Tuleville, another community with contaminated drinking water. And they sued the Department of Public Health saying that you have to do this plan, that we're all communities that have contaminated drinking water. And also the clients, you know, are well aware that this isn't just an issue in Tulare County. It's a San Joaquin Valley issue and a statewide issue.
And I do want to point out that we did invite the Department of Public Health on this program to speak to this issue, and they did decline. So we just want to be fair with that and let our listeners know that we did invite them in to speak on this issue. Now, the consensus seems to be that the contamination, which is nitrate, is coming from farms and dairies. What kind of response are you getting from the ag community with this?
Well, I think, you know, it obviously the ag community is diverse. And so there's I think that there's differing reactions. You know, I think there's a lot of ag folks that are trying to figure out how to reduce the impacts of nitrates around around the valley and other parts of the state. There's the development of a regulatory program for the first time through the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And so we've been working with ag groups, with dairy groups, and you know, the Regional Water Board and other agencies to look at how there can be an effective program to start to prevent groundwater contamination from nitrates. And, you know, certainly ag and dairies are the major sources, but, you know, there's also septic systems and sewer systems. But really, we feel like no matter what, this is a preventable problem. Nitrate is a preventable problem, and we need to be reducing the impacts from all of those sources, and particularly the largest ones. And so this is an opportunity through the Regional Water Quality Control Board to establish some guidelines and, you know, and measures to actually protect groundwater for the first time. It's really, you know, it's sort of an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. Groundwater, we don't see it, and so we don't think about it much. And so there really haven't been programs before this to protect groundwater from things like fertilizer application. So this is an exciting step, and I think one that everyone has been, you know, from the ag industries and, you know, various agencies and environmental justice groups looking at how we can develop the most effective program.
I would like to bring in Dr. David Zoldowski. He is with the California Water Institute. And my question is, Laurel was just saying that this is preventable. Are there ways for us to better protect our groundwater?
Yeah, thank you for inviting me today. Well, certainly, I think we're getting better from the standpoint of ag with the adoption of drip and micro irrigation. Allows much more uniform control in the field, particularly when it's used to what we refer to as chemigation, applying nitrates, nitrogen through the drip line. So I think the tools are better now. I think a lot of what we're dealing with is sort of legacy stuff. It's, you know, it was 50s, 60s, way back, but it's there, and we're going to have to deal with it. So I think there's an awareness now also of the issue. So, you know, at least from our perspective, we see a lot more focus on trying to do a better job. And and we have the tools now to do a better job. So I think we're all moving in the right direction. Are we perfect yet? Of course not, but I think there's a lot of awareness and momentum towards trying to bring this under control for everyone.
Okay. Now, from what I've read is that we found this nitrate in a lot of towns in Tulare County, a lot of small towns. But I can tell you my years as a reporter, going back, you know, 10, 15 years, covering a story where they found plumes of contaminated water right here in Fresno and moving through many of the central core of the city, what would now be the central core. Back then it was North Fresno, the central core of the city, and having to close down wells. And you think in this day and age, it's really, why are we, you know, having to do that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a problem everywhere. And I think it's something that we tend to, you know, we haven't done a good job at protecting our drinking water sources and stopping and preventing the problem before it happens. And one of the big, you know, in terms of just economics, it costs a lot more to clean up these things than and you know, mitigate all of these problems than to prevent it to begin with. And so I think, you know, as a state, we need to be looking at and locally looking at how we can put measures in to prevent these things before it happens, whether it's nitrate or other industrial contaminants. And, you know, that sort of goes to something that we've been trying to do, which is establish a statewide policy recognizing the human right to water and establishing a goal for the state that all Californians should have a basic amount of safe drinking water for their basic human needs. And setting that as a goal that all state agencies need to work towards in all of their programs and can be sort of an overarching goal that I think everyone agrees with. It's not, you know, it's something that ultimately can save money for the state in terms of, you know, the cleanup costs, the cost of having to treat water, the cost for residents to have to buy bottled water, you know, and not to mention the health impacts that are very real.
Oh, no, they're very real. And I think, too, there should be, for those of us here wanting to do that, it's my understanding when you have a United Nations investigator come through here and compare our drinking water to a third world country, that should make people kind of wake up and take notice.
I'd like to just add a couple of thoughts, if I could.
Yes.
You know, one of the challenges we have here in the valley is we have wet and dry cycles, and we do need to get water back into the ground to recharge our groundwater, which, you know, continues to be overdrafted, which is another topic for another show. But we need to make sure that our regional planning and Fresno State and the Water Institute is very involved in trying to develop or help participate in the regional planning for the eight counties, Kern County up to San Joaquin, such that we look to take good mountain water when we have it in abundance and get it into the ground and not use the agricultural fields as we have in the past to get that water down into the aquifer, which takes with it, in many cases, some of the fertilizers and other things have been applied to the field. So first, I think we need to have an integrated plan that helps, that recognizes that we've got to recharge the groundwater, and we need to find better mechanisms to do that and have a delivery system that allows us to do that. And then second, we are, and Laurel knows this, we've been trying to, through the university, California State University system, develop a technical advisory center that will assist rural communities in dealing with some of these complex water quality issues, because we have many agencies and folks involved in this, but collectively the synergies haven't been there, I think, to deliver the programs, and so we're trying to help pull that together so that we can bring federal and state and local support to these rural communities that don't have the finances or the technical abilities to deal with these problems. I mean, they're very complex and very expensive in many cases, so we are trying to assist in that level at that area as well. So there are some things going on that I think are very positive, but there are some needs that just need to be addressed in a much broader context. How do we get water back in the ground that's fresh and good for drinking? And that's a whole nother level of effort.
Well, you know, and that's one of the good things, as far as establishing the California Water Institute at Fresno State, because you can probably be on the front lines of us addressing and solving some of these problems, because, you know, water has always been a big issue for us here in the Valley because, you know, we're ag-based. What are some of the things you're looking at that you think that is going to take for us to sustain or have quality drinking water? What is the Institute looking at now that could possibly help with that?
Well, one of the things we've been pursuing, the EPA has a designation for technical advisor centers in, I think, 8 other states in the nation, where they provide some financial support and some technical support to help develop the resource through the university systems. And so we have applied to the EPA to be designated for California. And so that's one thing that we think would be important, is to just establish the center and then use that as a clearinghouse for seeking support, financial support to provide the services to these communities. But I think it's just about raising the issue. I think that Laurel and the rest of them have done a terrific job in just getting the issue out there. It's been one of those, you know, sort of kept secrets. And I agree, it's not just about these disadvantaged communities. I live east of Clovis, and we have high nitrates in the water out there. The local school there had to go to bottled water because the well there at the school was, had too high nitrates. So this is a valley-wide issue and a statewide issue, actually. Even in Northern California and Southern California, there's instances where this continues to be a problem. So it's about raising awareness, it's about attracting resources, and it's really about organizing all those that are interested in helping solve this problem in a way that is effective in moving this problem to a solution.
And I just want to echo that and say that, you know, there's a lot of exciting plans that are starting now and bills that have just been passed in terms of solutions and moving forward. And, you know, in addition to this lawsuit that has, is going to result in a safe drinking water plan for the state, there's a lot of local and state folks that have stepped up to create solutions. So, you know, like you said, Fresno State has been a real leader in this. Actually, the Tulare County Board of Supervisors are taking on this issue through a new study that is developing regional solutions for drinking water and wastewater challenges in the Tulare Lake Basin. So that's 4 counties. And the first meeting is going to be October 24th at Tulare County Board of Supervisors chambers. And, you know, this is really an opportunity to develop shared long-term sustainable solutions for the region and particularly for disadvantaged communities. And I think it's an exciting time to be able to, be focusing on solutions and moving forward in a way that recognizes that this is sort of all of our problems as a region and something that we can work towards and really develop that plan for how we're going to solve it. I also just wanted to point out that there was, you know, we did pass a package, a human right to water package of bills that was passed and signed by the governor just last Friday. And, our local legislator, Henry T. Perea, passed great legislation. And I think are big steps forward in helping communities.
And we also want to point out that we did talk to members of the Tulare County Board of Supervisors. They meet today on Tuesday, so they couldn't join us, but they were willing, and we'd like to thank them for that. So what we have here is a heightened awareness of the problem, and now we are now getting legislation where we can move forward, and we have the great, what I want to call, think tank at Fresno State helping with this issue. So it looks like at some point we're gonna finally start making some headway on what has been a ongoing long-term problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely feel optimistic about it. I mean, I think we've got some important bills were just passed that I think will make it easier for communities to access the funding they need. I think we've got some planning processes that are moving forward to really develop a plan for how we're going to solve this. And I think we've got a lot of diverse groups, including Fresno State and community groups, local lawmakers, and local representatives and agencies that are on board in helping to solve these problems. So I think it's been it really helps to have light shed on this and make it something that there's a greater awareness of. But it's really going to take all of us to solve.
Yeah, I would agree with Laura on that. And I think, there are so many communities impacted by this. And I think more now than ever before, people are really coming together and, pushing for this and saying that, we have a right to clean and affordable drinking water and, are really getting this issue out. And community residents, like never before, are really building that capacity and really getting involved in a big way. So,
and Dr. Sadowski, I want to give you a chance to kind of wrap this up. On your end?
Well, just that I can tell you that the university is committed to water as a theme across the whole campus, and actually we're in the process of hiring over the next couple of years 6 new faculty members that will be engaged in water, be it the health and human services area, engineering, ag, business. So I think it's about getting resources, targeting those resources, and raising awareness. And as it was said, just to repeat what my colleagues have said here, is that it's going to be a group effort. No one can do it alone, and it's going to be a long journey. But we've started with the first step, and I suspect it will be successful. And I look forward to that day when everybody has access to fresh drinking water.
Well, I thank you all for joining in the conversation this morning. Laurel Firestone, co-director, Community Water Center, and also an attorney. Kara Brodefer, California Rural Legal Assistance, and Dr. David Zoldowski with the California Water Institute at Fresno State. Thank you all for joining us this morning. We'll be right back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to a Valley Edition. Well, folks, we're right in the middle of fair season, the big Fresno Fair. Joining us now is Stacy Rionda. She is with the Fresno Fair, and we are in our 128th year, and every year they try to make something new and fantastic with this, and there's something new every year. So what's new this year?
The worst thing that as a fair manager you can hear is people say, it's the same old thing. Seen it, been there, done that. You never want to hear that. So we're constantly trying to improve. This year, one of our big changes that we've had a lot of great comments on is the fact that we moved our Kittyland Carnival out to the infield of our racetrack. So not only did that open up 76,000 square feet in our main carnival to create larger lanes, to bring in more rides and make the main carnival more exciting, but we've also created a safer, calmer, more family-friendly environment in Kittyland. It's on grass, and it is beautiful. And the single mothers and families have really been enjoying the fact that it's separate from the main carnival, and they don't have to compete.
Worry about trying to keep track of their kids.
Right? Exactly. It's a smaller, contained area, and it has gone over like gangbusters. We're so excited about that change.
Well, I have to tell you, every year it really does just the aesthetics out there. You all have done such a great job of making it just a nice place to be.
Thank you. Yes, we try very, very hard. One of the other changes that we did, we added a cattleman's mural at the main entrance to our livestock pavilion. So as you walk in, you're walking past big boulders and grass and a big tree that's holding a mural of a cattleman on his horse herding cattle across a river. And as you walk through, our hand washing stations have been transformed into a barn-like setting, and we're paying homage to the cattlemen of Fresno County and the people who actually came here, the trailblazers, and started this land with the cattle business. So it's another educational, really beautiful addition to our fairgrounds.
And that is one of the things the fair does is, you people can use this in so many ways. You're sort of like a art gallery to showcase the latest artwork, and then education tool. So many school kids come through there to just get a hands-on kind of a view of what's interesting and big here in current in Fresno County.
Yes. Everything that we do, we try to add an educational component to so that while you're having fun and enjoying the scenery, you're also learning something, whether you know it or not. I'd like to sneak in that education.
Well, you know, and I mean, everybody goes to the fair for their favorite food. You know, you forget about the diet. You don't think about it because, you know, over the next 2 weeks, I'm going to eat whatever it is I want to eat. So what has been, you know, the new big thing this year when it comes to what you're offering? Everybody has their favorites, but we always have something new.
Yes, we always have something new in the way of food. This year, the big hot item is the fried Kool-Aid. Now, I have not tried this myself.
Fried Kool-Aid. Never.
Yes.
How can you fry Kool-Aid? But I'm sure they find a way to fry anything.
Yes, they do. And I've actually talked to people who have tried it, and they said it's delicious. So I don't know. I may have to break down and give it a try before fair's over.
But, you know, this is just not a fun event. It's also huge for Fresno County's economy. You talk about attracting over 500, a half a million people every season, you know, when you do this. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for Fresno County when you look at the economy and just showcasing what we have here?
Well, we affect the economy in Fresno County in so many different ways. One of the ways is by putting people to work. We have 1,000 positions that we fill that, depending on what department you work for, that you can start in August and run through the beginning of November, or you may just work the 12 days of the fair. It just depends. But we had our first ever job fair this year in July, and we had 1,000 positions to fill. In 4 hours, we had over 8,000 applications,
wow,
which speaks volumes about the unemployment in this county and how desperate people are to get back to work and just do something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one way. We also contribute over $68 million in direct and indirect tax revenue to Fresno County and the city, because everybody who comes here, from our vendors to our patrons, buy gasoline. They stay in hotel rooms. They eat at our restaurants. And our vendors who are actually on the fairgrounds buy locally. They buy from our local manufacturers, from restaurant supply stores, from different suppliers like the meat market, JM Equipment, rents equipment to a lot of our vendors. So when you bring that many people together into one area, it's got to have some kind of an effect. And $68 million is a lot of money to Fresno County and the city.
Right. Now you're going into your second and final week.
Yes.
So far, the weather has truly cooperated, except for that one little day of rain on opening day.
Yes.
But after that, you've had great weather. So I'm sure you're expecting this final week to be just a really good week for you.
We are. And we have some great promotions still going on this week, coming into the weekend. And
some of those would be?
Today is $2 Tuesday. So if you're a big fan, you were emailed a coupon to get into the fair for just $2 today. And if you're not a big fair fan, you can sign up at FresnoFair.com, or you can just bring any receipt from Save Mart Supermarket or Food Max to any of our gates, and you'll still get in for $2 today, which is a huge savings because regular fair admission is $10. So that's pretty significant.
Huge. Yeah.
Yes. And Thursday is probably one of our best and most successful promotions that we've had. It's our Feed the Need food drive. It runs from 11:30 to 5:30 on Thursday. And if you bring 4 cans of food or non-perishable food items, you can get into the fair absolutely free. And you're helping to feed the people of Fresno County.
Okay. Well, Stacy, Rionda, thanks so much for coming in today. And thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Valley Edition, and I'm Juanita Stevenson.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.